Good morning and welcome to the Philadelphia United Lodge of Theosophists. We are one of many such lodges situated around the world, each acting autonomously as its own study center, but each united in general purpose and heartfelt constitution. The basis for the unity is actually declared in a few brief paragraphs that are beautifully written and actually could be used for a lifetime of study, and we'd like to share those words with you at this point this morning. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on end and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Those few paragraphs are the one governing piece, if you will, that independent thinkers and seekers from a variety of walks of life read and come to base their heartfelt efforts on. There's no officers or bylaws, but all the activities in this particular building radiate from this set of declared purposes. On Sundays, the building opens at 10:30. There's always a student associated with the cause, a volunteer who's at the book table. And before the meeting or after the Sunday meeting, you can avail yourself of straight line theosophical literature for use at home, or you can examine a piece of literature and then contact electronically Phoenix ULT, Philadelphia ULT, and come up with the literature for use at home also on your computer. The morning talks on Sunday start at 11 and end promptly at 12. This month of January has been dedicated to the theme of Keys to Spiritual Growth. And this morning, we will have a panel discussion of the importance of gratitude and humility, and that will tie that theme together. The month of February, the theme will be the facets of self-discipline. And so next Sunday, first Sunday, February 7th, raising the self by the self will be the topic. On Wednesday nights, the Association of Students also opens the building at 5:15. The library opens, and there are students available to assist with independent lines of research. It's a high-quality, straight-line theosophical library, a reference library. It's not a lending library. At 7:30, promptly after that library has closed, there is a study class that begins, and that class goes from 7:30 to 8:30. And this winter, we are studying the Articles of the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. All of these activities are sustained by voluntary contributions of study and otherwise, time, service, money, anything you can imagine that this elderly building would need to stay open during the winter months. So if you find that this philosophy rings true within your own heart and you would like to volunteer to assist in any shape or form, please talk to the person at the book table before or after meetings, and you can get assistance in how to assist. This morning, the panel partnership will be looking at the importance of gratitude and humility. And again, we're thinking about overall the keys to spiritual growth. So we'll begin first with the importance of gratitude. As we were thinking about this and beginning to review some notes and do some reading for it, we recalled that around 1975, a magical time, the last 25 years of the century, there seemed to be, to theosophical students who were also students of human nature, this bubbling up of the issue of gratitude. It was the era of simple abundance, if you recall that, of gratitude journaling. And all of this kind of centered around, if you will, heartfelt consideration of what life could bring in terms of a bloom in some degree of materialism. It was a little bit more than a Pollyanna hippie stance left over from the 60s and early 70s, but it wasn't really focused in a particular keynote, if you will. Now in 2016, Philadelphia has noted throughout the psychological studies, throughout the university levels, as a center, a seat of psychological research into the nature of happiness and positive psychology, or the psychology of positivism. And in some ways, that seems to be a bloom of what was observed decades before. But these thoughts about gratitude are modern, they're transitory, they change from decade to decade, if you will. And they do seem to follow cycles. In the 50s and 60s early, there was a cycle of articles on gratitude in the Theosophical Movement magazine coming out of India. But the ancient key and the ancient tone, if you will, to gratitude and spiritual growth remains foggy or hidden in those modern expressions, the popular expressions. In the writings of Crosby, one of the consummate students of theosophy, in Occult Side of Nature, we're reminded that the basis of nature, one spirit, an impersonal deific essence, is the reality, and that each in manifestation is a microcosm of that one, and that all the great powers of nature that flow in the direction of spiritual evolution exhibit themselves by law spontaneously within each of us. And in that system of thought, in which spirit precedes matter, in which spirit, mind, heartfelt convictions override our living through and in a physical brain and a physical body, we know that gratitude, when we possess everything externally, is really nothing, because at heart, in spirituality, we desire no thing. We desire that deific essence that is so pure and true within each one of us. And so as we evolve spiritually, we seek to arouse ourselves to the path of spiritual evolution, for sure. And we're reminded that there's so many ways to be grateful, to hold a tone of that oneness, to be aware that the guru parampara chain that we hear of frequently throughout the philosophy, that oneness of life that radiates throughout all conditions of manifestation, from the lowest awareness of life to the very highest that we can envision right now, each step of that chain of being is meant to help the one below and the one above. And that cycling, that circling of assistance from the lowest to the highest and back is truly the spiritual basis for gratitude. And it forms a center within us from which we can begin to transmit what we've learned and receive and accept more from the others that accompany us on the path of life. And so as our declaration says, we fit ourselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. And in that innate instinct to nurture, in that is a direct cognition of gratitude. That we come back to this planet, life after life, seeking purpose in life for sure, striving to perfect the use of body, mind, and soul, so that none of this can be achieved alone, because we're truly not alone. In the pages of the Dhammapada, a collection of statements by the Buddha, there is a statement that says, it is difficult to obtain birth as a human being. It is difficult to live the life of a man. It is difficult to hear the true law. It is difficult to attain enlightenment. And in the face of all that difficulty, is it not so important to remain grateful? Grateful to that one source. Grateful to the law of periodicity in which free will and choice can play out in the human state. Grateful for the potential within each thinker, identical to the source. Should we not be grateful to the efforts of past lives that have brought us together and to this room, if you will, to all the companions on the path of life that we encounter, however fleetingly. Perhaps it's just a clerk at the store. Perhaps it's a street cleaner who helps us set the tone for the day when he says, isn't this a beautiful morning? But certainly, gratitude comes foremost for those who have reached an enlightened state and have done the ultimate service to humanity and continue to do so, either in a body or out of a body, offering wisdom and consolation and the wind, or the wind beneath our wings as we work to improve our own use of character on behalf of the whole. HPB writing in The Key said that gratitude does more good to the man who feels it than for whom it is felt. It is in the practice of being grateful, in the concerted effort to remain grateful, that each thinker brings heart and mind together in a moment of spiritual communion, realizing, envisioning the oneness of all of us, and therefore creates immortality in the memory of nature. A greater realization of the true nature of self and a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood.
Hmm. Well, I just don't think anybody would want to follow that polished a presentation. We're grateful for it, but however. We realized from the outset that we had no idea the basis of the word humility. What does it come from? We were shocked to find that it comes from humus, dirt, soil, what is the lowest, what is beneath. And therefore, the definition of humility is modesty, diffidence. But if we turn to the philosophy, we find that it is not a lowering of yourself in the sense of sort of false humility, but a genuine spiritual realization. We start with the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna tells Arjuna how the wise act. Now, these are just some of what he taught him. He is wise whose undertakings are all free from desire. He abandoneth the desire to see a reward for his actions, is free, contented. He is not solicitous of results, with mind and body subdued. He is contented with whatever he receives, the same in success and failure. Even though he act, he is not bound by the bonds of action. Wherefore, perform thou works even as they were performed by the ancients. Learn well what is action to be performed, what is not to be, and what is in action. And after, let's say, 25 more paragraphs of description of those who are wise, Krishna tells Arjuna how to get that wisdom. Seek this wisdom by doing service, by strong search, by questions, and by humility. The wise who see the truth will communicate it unto thee, and knowing which thou shalt never again fail. How simple. Serve, study, ask questions, and be humble. Those are the steps to gain the wisdom of the wisest. If we turn to the voice of the silence, we're given the doctrine of the I is for the crowd, the doctrine of the heart for the elect. The first repeat in pride, behold, I know. The last, they who in humbleness have garnered, lo, confess, thus have I heard. And then this injunction, be humble if thou wouldst attain to wisdom. Be humbler still when wisdom thou hast attained. So we looked for some examples in our time of those who are considered truly humble. And we found two wonderful ones. One was written by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who was the former chief rabbi of Great Britain and the British Commonwealth. And he was writing about meeting for the first time with the Hasidic leader, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson. And he wrote this: heir to the leadership of a relatively small group of Jewish mystics, he turned the tattered remnants of his flock into a worldwide movement. Wherever I traveled, I heard tales of his extraordinary leadership, many verging on the miraculous. But he was certainly not charismatic in any conventional sense. Quiet, self-effacing, understated, one might hardly have noticed him had it not been for the reverence in which he was held by his disciples. Meeting him changed my life. He was a world-famous figure. I was an anonymous student from 3,000 miles away. Yet in his presence, I seemed to be the most important person in the world. He asked me about myself. He listened carefully. He challenged me, quickly it became clear to me that he believed in me more than I believed in myself. As I left the room, it occurred to me that it had been full of my presence and his absence. Perhaps that is what listening is, considered as a religious act. I then knew that greatness is measured by what we efface ourselves towards. There was no grandeur in his manner. Neither was there any false modesty. He was serene, dignified, majestic, a man of transcending humility who gathered you into his embrace and taught you to look up. Thus, humility is the capacity to admire, the capacity to be open to something greater than oneself. False humility is the pretense that one is small. True humility is the consciousness of standing in the presence of greatness. And then this, we recently celebrated his birthday in this country, Martin Luther King. And this is from the New York Times, written by William Ford, the last surviving grandson of Henry Ford. It's really quite amazing. He had a conversation with Martin Luther King, and then he wrote this. As I stammered an answer I cannot recall, he, Martin Luther King, listened with the concentration of someone who genuinely wanted to understand. Never before, and rarely since, had I witnessed such authentic humility. It was so simple, so powerful a form of energy that for a few moments it freed me from bondage to myself. So there we have two samples of humility that humble us. We should, in all our practices in life, become a good listener and respecting the absolute unity of life, as we heard in gratitude. We have produced a copy of some quotes for you that you may get at the book table after, because sometimes a quote can help you carry a seed idea better than a long paragraph. And we'll just read you a few of them. C.S. Lewis, humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. Ezra Taft Benson said, pride is concerned with who is right. Humility is concerned with what is right. And this is anonymous. Remain humble in your speech. Let your actions tell the story. Lao Tzu, all streams flow to the ocean because it is lower than they are. Humility gives the ocean its power. Ed Parker, the humble man makes room for progress. The proud man believes he is already there. And then this very sarcastic one, on the highest throne in the world, we still sit only on our own bottom. Michel de Montaigne. We, of course, have other wonderful quotes in the philosophy from the letters, from a Mahatma letter, and from students writing today about why we have to be aware of our own power, of our own spirituality, of our own identity with even the greatest thinker. We're all of one essence. But at the same time, we have to be humble because we are all of one essence. We cannot stand out from what we are identical to. So in gratitude for what has been given to us, we humbly pass it on. Now, your questions are, of course, invited. Yes?
In regards to being humble, it was kind of curious because we realized we didn't know, is this a process? I mean, can one just say, oh, I'm just being too prideful, I'm being too full of myself, I'm going to become humble? I mean, how does one come to the realization that maybe they need to be humble?
Well, sometimes people will tell us, and we can be grateful if possible, but, you know, we think the easiest way to answer questions like that, that are really very deep and psychological, is to take it from the mundane, the practical. If you're speeding along the highway at 60 miles an hour, maybe that isn't speeding anymore, and you want to go in the other direction, what do you have to do? Well, there are several steps. You have to slow down, and after you slow down, you can step on the brakes and stop, and then you can turn and go in the other direction. Our problem as humans, and maybe also as Westerners, is we think we can do things immediately. We want to go from selfish to selfless, and you can't. You have to have unselfish in between. So if we feel and we know we're proudful about something, the first step is to stop being that proud of it, to look at it. Where did you learn it? And then begin to realize the humble gratitude that you have to have for those who gave you this wisdom. None of us created any of what we are studying. Mm-hmm. How can we not be humble in the face of all that wisdom? Yes.
We see that most of the world thinks about themselves first and then others afterwards. And I think you were quoting Gita saying that, that we should think of others first and ourselves after that. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
In the process of, do we think of ourselves first and then others, or others first and ourselves, we're reminded of what seems to be that counterintuitive instruction in an airline where they say, you know, in the event of an emergency, get your own oxygen mask on first. And to anyone traveling with a small child or an invalid, you think, what are you, nuts? You know, you're intuitively, you should care for the other. Well, it's all of one piece, isn't it? In order for us to be able to slow down and put on the brakes and make that turn, in order for us to determine, is our pattern, is our habit to think of ourselves first and another one second, what's going on is thought in all those circumstances, and a metacognition, if you will. We have to be aware or mindful as we possibly can be, moment by moment by moment, so that we are equipped, we are oxygenated spiritually in order to help the other, in order to make that U-turn without clipping the truck that's coming up behind us. Awareness and thought is the starting point. And very gradually, as we use that awareness to observe human nature and to observe in ourselves and around us, we become more and more aware that to help the other is really to help the self. You know, the Indian phrase namaste, that concept that within the kernel of what we perceive as the other is actually the same as what is within each of us. So is it the chicken and the egg? I don't have an answer. Do you?
Well, except in something like this, but maybe it would also apply in any kind of what we would call higher learning. There is a sense of gratitude that we feel for the one who knew more and probably still knows more, but has humbled themselves to give it and share it with us, a nobody in comparison to them. So there's humility and gratitude all mixed up in the relationship of teacher to student. Well, then you move to the fact that all of us are teachers and students to each other. Mm-hmm. We learn from each other, we share with each other. So we don't know which comes first. And we can't trace our own history going backwards into the night of time, what we might have done, what we might not have done. All we can do is deal with this moment. And as was said, bring our focus of concentration. We should be able to be grateful and humble simultaneously. Consider, we're sitting here in a replica of what would have been the school of Plato. Consider that. I mean, if anybody had told you when you were searching for ideas that someday you might be part of a group where people discussed ideas like this, you would have been staggered. And yet, we have to have earned it in order to be in it. Yes?
So if we consider the two great personages you read about, who in fact were very humble, they obviously possess a genius of a skill that could not have possibly been learned in this life. They had to begin somewhere. So how do we begin? if we want to just begin to practice either humility or gratitude, is there something we can do every day to emulate or aspire to that?
If we establish a rhythm of life in which, as we awaken in the morning, we are thinking about living as though we were at one with the all, or living as though we were at the feet of the masters and the enlightened ones would accompany us and assist us. If we begin our day with that kind of tone, and that kind of imagination, image making. And we set aside a time in the morning, maybe for reading inspirational quotes, maybe for reading one of the inspirational books or listening to a piece of music, something that assists us in setting a tone of spirit over matter for that day. And then we anchor ourselves as we can throughout the course of the day, bringing mind and heart back to that point of view again. Gradually, that becomes a habit, a pattern, a force of energy, if you will, throughout the course of the day, and closing the day and reflecting before laying the body down for rest, closing the day with a period of contemplation. And consideration of what was that tone? Was I able to sustain it? Being a student of human nature, how did I do today? How did it flow? How did it move? And then rededicating a sense of these attributes as we fall asleep. That kind of practice is a good beginning.
And there's also the very mundane that some of us use. For example, you're maybe drying the silverware or something, and you drop a knife, and it doesn't land on your foot. It should have, because you were very klutzy. You take that moment to say thank you to the knife, to the universe, to your foot. You do that all day long. Every time there is something for which you feel grateful, you actually express it because it's real. And it builds up within yourself a different attitude. Even as a child, we never understood why people said grace. That was like making an exceptional moment for something that is grace all day long. Consider, you sit down to eat. You not only have gratitude for whoever prepared it, but whoever kept the dishes clean so that you could use them right now. Who raised this crop? who paid for the gas to put in the truck to truck that crop to somewhere near you where you could buy it? I mean, it is so complicated. If you think about it, the simplest meal in the world, even if you just sit down and eat an apple and nothing else, represents a chain of action of brotherhood that goes all the way across this country. And we're not grateful enough. We have to grow up and realize how important everyone and everything is to us. Yes?
So initially we were wondering from the first talk that the gratefulness that we're talking about is a higher spiritual one, like for the masters and the knowledge, that sort of thing. But as was just stated, do we also then need to be grateful for more of the mundane? Like in the 12-step programs, they talk about being grateful, you know, looking for that which, you know, if you're having a bad day, they say, you know, look, you know, be grateful for something, no matter how small. So is that, are we looking at finding the sacred in the mundane then?
Yes, of course. We are the sacred in the mundane, if we would just stop and realize it. We're spiritual beings trapped in bodies of clay, humus. So we have to be humble, but we also have to be grateful. You know, it isn't even just looking for incidents and things. I mean, wake up in the morning and be grateful that you have eyes and ears and hands that work and legs and feet and all the things you have that you can put to use for the aiding and assisting of the rest of life. Yes?
Well, isn't there a paradox here?
Yes.
Because we're talking about humility and gratitude like they were things. And then you said feeling. But in reality, you know, they're not words. They're a feeling that we engender in ourselves. And so it's not an intellectual pursuit.
No.
It's a heart pursuit. So how does our heart pursue?
Moment by moment by moment. And as you said so aptly, not in literally the pages of a book, you know, where we're like the C&E crowd in a Christian church, Christmas and Easter, they're filled to overflowing. It's not this intellectual pursuit where we can pick up something, study it for talk, and put it down. It's really a heart experience, and we're practicing the powers of the heart. They're there. It's being aware of them and expressing them. So moving through daily life, wherever that is, we can be grateful and feel a oneness for someone around us. Sometimes a smile from another is a remarkable gift. And we kind of, you know, glance over and say, oh, hi, and brush it off. Unaware or irresponsibly, in other words, without an awareness that I wonder what it took for that person to find that peace and contentment and bliss and then give it away. And be grateful for that. Humble to what the other has just done very simply and very grateful for that.
He wants to follow.
Yeah.
But doesn't the intellectual pursuit of that tie a knot in our heart that an idea that we have, whatever it may be, that we're separate or it's this way or that way, doesn't that tie a knot in us that we can't see things clearly? Like when we believe in a certain thing or, you know, that we're like Harris and Tubman, that we, you know, all these religious concepts and all these philosophical concepts, you know, that we've been exposed to all our life. And we know our heart is tied many times when we want to be compassionate and humble. We're like, how can I do that? My mind won't let me.
Ah. Is that so? How amazing. Because if it were something you wanted to do and the whole world got in your way, You wouldn't care what your mind said or didn't say. The knot in our heart is selfishness. We would do, but, and we have all these reasons why it might harm us. And that's where we're making our biggest mistake. The real sin that we all commit, and probably the only real sin, is separateness, selfishness. As long as we believe that we are unique and apart and one only to ourselves, we're going to have that knot in the heart. The minute we realize, we had a good quote from The Merchant of Venice, you know, Shylock's speech, just briefly. Have we not eyes, hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? Are we not all one and identical, even if we take it from the physical level? But Theosophy says you only have the physical because you are spiritual beings who need an instrument in order to see their own perfections, imperfections, powers, principles. We are here in the school of life, and the knot that prevents us from knowing, because the intellectual is important. The ideas you hold control you, and as long as we hold the idea that we're separate, we're going to be making stupid mistakes.
And the thought comes to mind also that we've incarnated skillions of times. I mean, each of us as a soul has generated myriads of causes, and the effects are coming. So what for one may be a knot of the heart, for another might be a blindness of the mind, or a cage of the mind. It's so difficult to say, you know, the heart doctrine and the head eye doctrine are two different things, and which is the biggest obstacle. Each of us encounters in life the very obstacles that we've created in the past and that we need to revisit to grow again. There was a book written in 1948. It was an allegory called The Book of Mirdad. It was written by Mikhail Naima, a Lebanese philosopher. And in that book is a quote that says, "What the broom is to the house, self-searching is to the heart. Sweep well your hearts. Make no demands upon the world, which you make not upon yourselves, nor make demands on any man, which you allow him not to make upon you. All things must have a center from which to radiate and around which to revolve." So that process, that self-examination process, raising the personal by the universal, attempting to live by heartfelt principles that may also be reasoned out, it's for each of us, and therefore for the all.
You had your hand first.
So, it's very interesting that humility comes from the root hummus, which is
earth. No, hummus is chickpeas. that's garbanzo beans. No, it's humus.
Okay, well, good. I've been eating hummus too much anyway. So anyway, let's start over.
It's interesting that it comes from humus, yes.
So then,
excuse me.
Okay, the point I'm trying to make is that, so then, human and humanity must also
come from the same
root.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, sorry.
The ground.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we, that must be, to be fully human, must be, you know,
that you're solid and dependable, but not changeless. The human side of our nature, if we were really human, the human is the instrument of spirit. We live in the human instead of being spiritual beings using the human. We use our humanity as an excuse to not live up to our humanity. It's a wonderful paradox. You had your hand up.
Actually, just an extension of what was just said. If you look at the word humus, humus is, you know, combination, or rather, human is a combination of humus and manus. Perhaps so, human.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And sometimes we think actually to be more fully human, let's try to be more fully human before we get off into this abstract
exactly.
God thing. And step by step. But we recall an awesome Oprah show, and she, it was all about gratitude, and it was many years ago. And she, her emphasis was, you know, wherever you are, whatever the issues, whatever your problems, that which we focus upon grows.
Mm-hmm.
So why not focus on what we're grateful for, and
yeah.
that will grow. And her little exercise that she gave the world, and it works wonders, is a gratitude journal. And just
yes.
every day write down five
oh,
things
nice.
That you're grateful for. Just
mm-hmm.
do that every single day, and it's just a neat thing. It could have an effect on a lot of people.
Did everyone hear that?
With the yeah. gratitude journals? That is remains a tool used to this day. In rehab centers, whether it's rehab centers for acute recovery from physical or neurological problems, or whether it is rehab centers that support cancer victims as they recover. But the gratitude journals that were part of that Simple Abundance movement, and she was the key figure in that movement so long ago, they honed or they focused on the uplift of being grateful for the immediate surroundings first. And as that habit of being aware and grateful began to expand, the idea is that the awareness would spiral into the loftier and loftier. So we don't have to worry about being grateful for these universal principles that may be difficult to envision right now. It's the beginning of it. It's the planting the seeds and the practice that begins to uplift. And you know yourself, some days when you walk into a room and the room is in silence, you have no idea of what happened an hour ago in that room, but you can see the effect among the humans in the room at that point. And frequently when you walk in, you can encounter it and sit quietly, or you can work with it and try to uplift it. Those gratitude journals and that effort to be heartfelt and to express that has a life of its own, an attraction, a magnetism of its own.
We are often humbled by the fact that a group like this, and as was mentioned earlier, there are lodges all over the world. And in every case, it is the same people feeling gratitude for what was given to them, continuing to keep the place going with whatever it takes, study, work, pennies, if pennies are what's needed. But the fact is that the way you respond to anything is a statement of gratitude. The way you treat your parents, the way you treat your children, the way you treat anything and everything is your statement of gratitude. So we do have to be very careful in how we respond to everyone and everything in life. You had your hand up before?
Well, it was just sort of touched upon that gratitude is not just a feeling, no matter how grand it is, it's even the smallest effort to pay it forward,
yes.
or to
yes.
pour it forth into another bread. You have to give back that which you're grateful for.
Right. And the awful thing is we don't realize we are always paying it forward. We don't need an occasion for it. In all of our interactions with life, we are paying it forward, and the person we're paying it forward to is ourselves. We are creating the conditions of our next physical environment, of our next mental capacity. It's awesome when you think about it.
We think, though, in regards to that, though, we should have a motive of doing good for others rather than realizing that by paying it forward, it's doing good for us. But that shouldn't be.
But that's not our motive. That's the reality.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, that's very well said. And there's a paradox as well that could be pursued in a lifetime of study. What are my motives and how pure are they? The earlier comment was that between selfishness and selflessness, there is degrees of awareness. And at some point, self-centeredness is in there as well. But that kind of motive of wanting to purify, wanting to develop soul experience with which to serve and with which to unite and with which to help world peace, whatever the lofty idea is, the process of that evening review where we look at our motives and determine, is it a mixed motive? Was it a pure motive? Did something trigger me so that I was off base? You know, that kind of awareness and that kind of sweeping away the cobwebs off the heart is really, really key. We can really trick ourselves with motives, can't we?
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, who knows better than each one of us what our real feelings and motives are? We just don't want to look. It's not very comfortable. But the reason we look, the reason we do that review, is we want to be in service of the highest. And back to the earlier point, you have to begin cleaning up yourself, your thinking, your motives, your heart. You have to do that work before you can possibly help any other. So it's a twofold process. We didn't mean that realizing we're paying it forward means we can create the best thing for ourselves. We just meant we're unaware that we think we're interacting with the world, but we're really interacting with our own future creation, the next personality.
There's another way to explore that notion. If you pursue a study of the enlightened ones, of the masters, and you come to the concept that soul exists sometimes bodiless, and that the great ones can work behind the scene, but are not necessarily able to work with direct matter. Some of the motive for this cleaning up process is the realization that if masters need companions with whom to work, through whom to work, is not the responsibility of each entity, each self-conscious thinker, to be all that can be, to perfect as much matter as possible so that masters have companionship and substances and sheaths of building being through which to work in the future. Uh-oh, you're awfully quiet.
I think you had your hand up first in the back. Yeah, you.
You in the white shirt.
We all have something in common. It's called a personality. Now, that personality we all have to deal with. And it seems that as great as it is, that greatness gets to be a problem. That we find ourselves being separate. Our personality has gotten us this far. Why should I abandon it? prideful and humble at the same time.
Who's asking you to abandon your personality? What's being asked is you should abandon your love of your personality. You should be grateful to it. It's a good vehicle. It allows you contact with life and experiences and with other souls.
It's a tool.
Yes, and with this wisdom, you don't give up the personality. You give up your attachment to it. It's like suddenly realizing, you know, if this were a contest between you and me and it was all just mental, poof, you're gone, I'm here. Because that's the way we think, that we have to take care of this because no one else will. But theosophy gives us the realization, wait a minute, you said it was a gazillion or a zillion?
Oh, gazillion.
Okay, we've been here a gazillion times. What's to be afraid of? Dare to try what we're given as wisdom. Become passionless about your personality. Have fewer desires. What are your desires? To be a good person. Don't go way up. To be a good person. To start being more unselfish. To be more aware of how I interact with life itself, including the life in my body. How many times do we drop something and go, oh, you idiot? Well, that's not right. We're not an idiot. We were clumsy, that's all. We weren't paying attention. So we have to stop being supercritical or hypercritical and be aware. This exchange of ideas, of life, of principles. We need a personality to do it. So clean up the personality. Make it more of a good tool.
Now, I have to apologize in advance.
Uh-oh.
Because I got this statement, I got this idea, I guess from one of the Theosophical Movement articles on gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the citation. It says, as we gain flashes of fully opened vistas of existence, the beginningless past, the endless future, the door of unthinking responsibility closes. So as that process goes on and we begin to flash on reality, what is there left?
Almost out of time here.
Oh gosh, yeah.
We'd like to end with what the Mahashohan wrote in what's called the Great Master's Letter. It is we, the humble disciples of the perfect lamas, who are expected to allow the Theosophical Society to drop its noblest title, that of the Brotherhood of Humanity, to become a simple school of psychology. No. No, our brothers, you have been laboring under the mistake too long already. Let us understand each other. He who does not feel competent to grasp the noble idea sufficiently to work for it need not undertake a task too heavy for him. Oh, for noble and unselfish men to help us effectually in that divine task. All our knowledge, past and present, would not be sufficient to repay them.
Mm.
Now, this is the promise for which we can be grateful. All our knowledge, past and present, would not be sufficient to repay them, those who strive for universal brotherhood. Our meeting is adjourned.